want to talk about metta for self, because many, many of us are doing that. Not all of us, but many of us. And the power of vulnerability and the power of joy. All in 3 hours. I'll just keep talking till the last person leaves the room. Truthfully, though, you all are the hardest group to give a Dharma talk to, because I can't use any of my, you know, all my poems and jokes and my little, you know, sayings, and so I have to work really hard to not recycle something, and then my biggest fear is, oh yeah, didn't I give this talk to you last May? You know, I just didn't remember it, so anyway. You're pretty kind to me with the repetition, so... So, metta for self. And let's just take a minute and close our eyes and just feel into the experience inside our body. What sensations obvious right now? Feel into what's in the mind, thought or image, what's obvious. And really get it. This is your home. This is where you live and have lived. And just like the Steinberg cover of the New Yorker, where the view is out in tall, you know, high-story apartment window, and you see the skyscrapers and Fifth Avenue and 8th Avenue and 10th Avenue, and that's 90% of your view, and there's a tiny little blip of New Jersey and the tiniest little blip of China in the horizon. This world you live inside is just like that. It's large. The view from inside your home, you have to see past your history and your projections and your assumptions and your values, you know, to the little tiny shore of something outside of you. And this is just how we are. Nobody knows how it feels inside your body right now, inside your mind. Only you can know this, how it really feels to live in your home. And this home carries your history. Maybe you have scars on your body from childhood. You inherited this body from a child's body, and the patterns are there. And this mind you inherited from a child's mind, and the child's patterns are there. This home carries your history, and it carries human history, and even pre-human history. Why does this body of yours walk on two legs? Because the climate changed in East Africa 4 or 5 million years ago, and lush forests went to savanna, and an ape evolved to walk on two legs. You take this body so personally, but it's got the entire history of the earth in every step you take. If you breathe in oxygen right now, the history of the earth is in every breath, because 2 billion years ago, before photosynthetic bacteria, there was no oxygen. And evolution through bacteria invented photosynthesis, and bacteria started off gassing oxygen as they made energy. And life evolved to thrive on the energy of oxygen. So we take this home of ours so personally, and yet it's constructed out of the history of events long ago. The DNA, the cells, all the organelles within the cells, possibly, you know, were single-celled organisms that evolved to merge into each other and become multi-celled organisms, and eventually became vertebrates and mammals and apes and humans. And then just consider the miracle of your heartbeat. We aren't just like a book on a shelf, an object, this body. This body is being maintained right now by this incredible life force of your heart. You can just feel the pulse in your body. Somewhere, your hands or your head. You don't have to actually even put your fingers on the pulse. You can just feel your life being given to you, 60 beats a minute, 70, 50. A lot is going very well today. This life isn't just here. It's being miraculously maintained by this heart, which started beating inside your mother's womb. How are you not a miracle? How is this home you live inside not a miracle? I just want to read from Marianne Williamson. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. I hope you can just feel just the miraculousness of being here at all. The fact that you're here is the greatest gift you'll ever get. It's all good after that, because you've already got the best thing you could ever get. A mind and a body and a heart and a personality, complete with a history and wounds and quirks and neuroses and brilliance. And this capacity to love, to feel warm, to care. And so only you live inside this home. So only you can really completely love yourself. And so our investigation tonight is just about, how are you doing inside your home? How are you speaking to yourself? Are you being kind? If there isn't love in your home, if you aren't shining it inside your sensations and thoughts and images, who will? So we have this responsibility to let our love light shine from inside our home and out the windows. To whoever comes in our home. But the love light has to be on inside the home. And so you take this miraculousness of you, and then, you know, you kind of spit in the face of God with your petty judgments and your harshness with yourself. We all do. We're all harsh. We speak to ourselves the way we would never be caught speaking out loud to others. And what's really difficult about the path of our practice is that it shows us how we talk to ourselves. And if you're lucky, you'll sort of cringe and be embarrassed. Because if you said that out loud, that's how you'd feel. But we think we get away with it. But we don't. Because there are these punishing voices inside our home. Completely denying the miraculousness of you. And we're so used to it, and the habit is so strong that we can say all this and think all this, and it sounds really nice. But then we just kind of go right back. And so we need this practice of many, 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 many repetitions of kind thoughts to ourselves. And your inner critic, you know, it wants you to believe that is the part of you that's, you know, kind of like tough enough for life. And it's reality-based. And, you know, you just need to nut up and get real, you know. And kind of like brace yourself for reality. But that's caca. Because judging mind is thinking mind. And if you're thinking it, it isn't true. Thoughts are not true in an ultimate sense because thoughts are trying to symbolize reality. So sort of by definition, they can't be reality. They can only attempt to symbolize or recreate it. So thoughts don't have ultimate truth. They can be useful. And that's what our thoughts can do. And there are definitely better thoughts than other thoughts. You know? I don't know. The thought Goldilocks was a gorilla. It's like not a good thought. It's just not useful. It's completely off and not true. You know? So thoughts are better than other thoughts in the sense that they can point more usefully towards reality. But they're always the finger pointing at the moon, as the Zen tradition says. They're never the moon. They can point at the moon, and then we can all look at the moon. But if you say, you know, there's the moon, and you point down at the ground, that's not a helpful thought. If you point at the moon, say, there's the moon, that's a helpful thought. And so that's what thoughts can do. They can be useful or helpful or not. So with a judging thought, all you have to say is, oh, here's a judgment. I know it isn't true, because it's a thought. Is it useful? And then the question is absurd, right? I'm so this, I'm so that, you know. How is that ever useful? Our judgments spit in the face of God. Because they just blind us to the miracle of being alive and being a person. I like this poem for judging mind. And I know a lot of you have heard me before, so bear with me. Billy Collins, another reason why I don't keep a gun in the house. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He's barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking. His eyes fixed on the conductor, who is entreating him with his baton. While the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo. That endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. That's your inner critic. Doesn't matter what is on. Beethoven or not. I just love that image of the dog just looking at the conductor and the conductor and treating him with the baton. The dog is so good at barking. So we can take the inner critic lightly because the inner critic isn't you. It might be barking a lot. You know? But, you know, like he says in the poem, the neighbors must turn him on when they leave the house. You know, something just turned on your inner critic. But it isn't you. It's conditions. The conditions are you're human, so you have a negativity bias of your brain. You're a Westerner, so you live in a very individualistic culture which requires us to be so much. And so we have to kind of judge ourselves to be super mom, super dad, super everything, you know? And our identity is not more communal. It's really individualized. And so we're very hard on ourselves. And that's cultural. That's not you. This is our culture. And then there's our family conditioning, where we might have had to learn to be judgmental to ourselves because our parents aren't wrong when you're 4 or 8, you know. You don't know enough to know how limited and flawed parents are. So they can't be wrong. I have to be wrong. So we judge ourselves into the shape to get the love we have to have because no child can live without it. So the judging, you know, is almost like a map of what you had to do to to survive your family. And of course, there was lots of love, and our parents, you know, did their best. But our parents fell short too. And so that isn't you. That's your conditioning. So the barking dog, you know, the famous barking dog solo, you know, just goes on out of a deep habit. And we can lighten up. Yes, it's painful. But then we realize it's brain farts. Silent but deadly. And we can laugh. We can just watch. Oh, there I go again. Yep, yep, yep. So what we have to do, when we hear the barking dog, we do have to put on some Beethoven, you know. We have to put on something very positive. And as some of you said, you know, we need gratitude, you know, to create connection with others. We need to slow down. You know, there's lots we need to do. We need to not compare so much, not judge so much. All the things you all said. We need to be very actively positive. Look for what's good, what's right, what's working, and be thankful. That's what we have to do. Because the barking dog got turned on. So, so this is what Ellen Bass has to say about this. Her poem is titled, "Don't Expect Applause," Tibetan Buddhist maxim. Don't expect applause. And yet, wouldn't it be welcome at the end of each ordinary day? The audience could be small, the theater modest, folding chairs in a church basement would do. Just a short, earnest burst of applause that you got up that morning and one way or the other made it through the day. You soaked up in the steaming shower, drank your Starbucks in the car, and let the guy with the Windex wipe your windshield during the long red light at Broad Street. Or maybe you were that guy, not daring to light up while you stood there because everyone's so down on smoke these days. Or you kissed your wife as she hurried out the door, even though you were pretty sure she was meeting her lover at the Flamingo Motel. Even though you wanted to grab her by a hand of a hank of her sleek hair. Maybe your son's in jail, your daughter stopped eating, and your husband's still dead this morning, just like he was yesterday and the day before that. And yet, you put on your shoes and take a walk, and when a neighbor says good morning, you say good morning back. Would a round of applause be amiss? Even if you weren't good, if you yelled at your kid, poisoned the ants, drank too much, and said that really stupid thing you promised yourself you wouldn't say, even if you don't deserve it. Would a round of applause be amiss? Metta for self. If we don't do it, who will? We're going to sit around in our house and wait for somebody to come over and give us applause. Why wait? Start now. And this metta for yourself, really what it basically means is just being kind to what is. If there's not, you know, an independent, separate, solid self in here, then what exactly is it we're being kind to? Basically, what it is everything that arises. Everything is arising to find a friend, remember? What we need to be kind to is our experience. Now, you know, I'm not exactly speaking about how we do it in metta practice, because we know how to do that. But, you know, when we're kind to ourselves, we're just kind to what arises. And the only way to do this is to replace that barking dog, that inner critic, Replace judgment with curiosity. It's all you have to do. Just take your fixed conclusion, which is very negative and therefore wrong, and very general and therefore wrong. I'm such a no good so-and-so. Negative, overly general, bullshit. Okay? So you just replace that judgment with curiosity. You can't judge and understand at the same time. Your judgment is a closed book, case closed, verdict reached. Nothing more can be learned. So we acknowledge the inner critic, we don't take it personally because we realize it's conditioning, and we change the channel. And mostly we change the channel by simply being curious instead of being judgmental. Pema Chodron has this to say. Sometimes you experience failed expectations as heartbreak and disappointment, and sometimes you feel rage. But at that time, instead of doing the habitual thing of labeling yourself as a failure or a loser, totally negative, totally general, that's not a statement about something you did. I'm a failure, I'm a loser. That's a statement of who you are, meaning the personhood statement, right? It's always wrong when you're doing that. Instead of doing the habitual thing of labeling yourself as a failure or a loser, or thinking there is something wrong with you, you could get curious about outer circumstances and how they are impacting you. Noticing what words come out and what your internal discussion is, this is the key. If there's a lot of, I am bad, I am terrible, simply notice that and soften up a bit. Instead say, what am I feeling here? Maybe what is happening is not that I am a failure. Maybe I'm just hurting. She's going from the actor language, I'm bad, I'm terrible, you know, I'm a failure, to, oh, what's actually happening? Which is, you know, a feeling. It's something, it's an action. This is what human beings have felt since the beginning of time. If you want to be a complete human being, if you want to be genuine and hold the fullness of life in your heart, then failure is an opportunity to get curious about what is going on and listen to the storylines. Don't buy the ones that blame it on everybody else, and don't buy the storylines that blame it on yourself either. You'll never guess where she said this. Right in Boulder, at the Naropa 2014 commencement address. But you see how she's just saying, replace those really negative statements with curiosity. It's very simple. So, being kind to what is means you have to connect with what is, means you have to drop any judgment and be curious. And then we've all done the practice of just say, of course. Just say, of course, to whatever's in your heart. Whatever twisted feeling you feel inside, metta is just to say, of course. Of course. All argument is over. You're not just accepting, you're being affectionate. Accepting. You're like a grandmother or a grandfather who's just kindly saying, of course, dear, to your little affliction. So being kind to what is really means being kind to everything, because everything arises. The difficult and the easy, the sorrow and the joy. It all arises. So really, metta for self is a big deal, because it means being kind to everything inside of you. here's a Japanese poet from the book The Enlightened Heart, which is kind of the poetry of enlightenment. This is Izumi Shikibu. 10th century. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely. No part left out. That's like an awakening experience. Because when you really fully awaken and realize you're not all these things that are happening inside, they're visitors, they're coming and going, only then can you really know yourself completely. Nothing left out. All your parts. Your judge, your glee, you know, your joy, your doubt, your fear, all of it, no part left out. And the awakened heart doesn't get afflicted by your afflictions. Sharon Salzberg uses this metaphor: when you develop a space-like heart, then the paint of your afflictions can't stain you. You can throw paint through space and it doesn't land on anything. It doesn't stain you. It isn't an affliction. And we develop this heart, this awake, spacious heart, both through metta and through mindfulness. Both practices. Maybe mindfulness creates this big open sky of space, and then metta is the sunlight that shines through the space. Big mind is big heart is big love. Nothing left out inside of us, and because we're not afraid of anything inside of us, we're not afraid of what's outside of us. So when we open to all of our parts, we open to the vulnerable parts. That is a necessary part of our path. We can't not open to what's vulnerable. Plenty of other stuff happens too. We get bored, we're restless, we're this, we're that, there's no drama. Some of you are reporting no drama on retreat. I'm so happy for you. I feel great, Mudita. We think we want the drama until we realize how nice it is to just have a quiet mind. So we open to the no drama territory, and we open to the drama territory, the great highs and the great lows. We open to all of it. Metta can open to all of it. And the vulnerable parts, metta involves just, you know, by accident. We stumble across something, some memory, where we really experience some vulnerability, some hurt, some anxiety, some shame, some sadness, guilt. And why does it happen? Simply because you're doing this undefended practice. It's undefended because we're just going along with our practice. Phrases, person, felt sense, the feeling of metta if it's there. And then boom. We just trip into some difficult place. And then what? Well, you're already doing metta, so metta. This vulnerable place is just something that needs attention, loving attention. It's arising to find a friend. Period. It needs to be met in the shape it's in. There's nothing to change. You love the thing for the shape it is. It's judging that makes things change shape. It's love that just meets things as they are. So you don't need to change the sadness or the fear or the anger. You just simply need to be kind to it. And some of you may find it helpful, or already do find it helpful. You know, we could almost think of our vulnerability as childlike, and that we can be the kind of wise, grounded, loving attention of a good parent. And our vulnerability is so appreciative. It really does. Whether you like that metaphor of kind of the child inside and the adult inside, that doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't matter. It's strength and vulnerability. Maybe those words work better for you. You know, but our strength needs to meet our vulnerability. You know, the vulnerability, the child inside needs to know we're more than just the affliction. We have a wise, kind, patient, steady presence. And so our vulnerability, for most of us, comes out of developmental wounds, comes out of our childhood, where there is an unmet need. And so really all we have to do is listen to the vulnerability and love it the way maybe our parents didn't, or reality didn't. And I love the theme this year of metta and mindfulness, because metta is so important. Metta for self, this kindness towards what's arising, is so important for your mindfulness practice, because it's always the first move of mindfulness. Accepting what's here is the beginning of mindfulness. It can't start any other way. So mindfulness starts with kindness. There's no other way. So you know the saying, the way out is through. It's through your vulnerability, you know, that you actually go somewhere in your heart towards healing. It's easy to get on the Buddhist path and kind of, you know, have experiences on retreat where the mind does get quiet or really concentrated, and you just think, oh boy, I don't have to ever walk through the bogs again. You know? But then you get off retreat and the first thing that happens is your sweetie has some big kerfuffle at home, and you know, there goes all your samadhi. Right? We can never progress on the path that way. That's called premature transcendence. You think you've transcended, but you haven't. There's work to do. There's shadow work. There's work through your vulnerability. Having to feel the things that are uncomfortable, that don't make you look good. There's no traction in your healing without opening was vulnerable. For you to heal, if there is any childhood wounding at all, the only way to heal is to open to what's vulnerable. Open to those childlike parts in us. You feel insecure, easily hurt, needy of love. But when you do turn towards these parts with metta, there's tremendous healing and magic. what we find in the vulnerability, it's a call for love. And when we love what's vulnerable, we find all these secret treasures, all these hidden qualities that were bound up in some kind of repressed part of ourselves. And so what looks like something difficult and needy and scared and hurt, when it gets love, it shows you the other side, which is just all the beauty and wonder and joy of being alive in the world. You know, if we think of our tough stuff as a vulnerable child, we also know about children who can move right through a difficult state and go right into joy, passion, enthusiasm, wonder, curiosity, you know? Inside of our vulnerability lies tremendous just optimism for life, creativity, playfulness, humor. All of that lies inside the vulnerability. But we get to those qualities, that's where the traction happens. We get traction, the wheels stop spinning. We actually learn something new. Our little vehicle of healing starts moving. Why? Just because we open to what's here in the moment with metta. When in my therapy training, I used to say, I'm just training as a therapist. If I can't have a situation where it's safe enough to be vulnerable, I'm not going to learn anything. We're just kind of spinning the wheels until we do the hard thing. The hard thing of sort of opening to the thing you don't want to open to. Start there. Right there. The minute you do, there's traction. The healing starts moving. I like what David White said. I don't remember exactly where, but something like, as soon as you name the nature of your exile, you're on your way home. And he's talking in a, you know, in a poetry context. So in a mindfulness or metta context, we say, as soon as you allow the nature of your exile, you're on your way home. All the stuff in you you don't like to feel. In the space of metta, it's okay. You can allow it because there's this warmth that you've cultivated. And you know you're bigger than that experience. And so it's okay. It doesn't afflict you. It's in your big, spacious heart of love. So, part of our vulnerability, a very, very important part, is that so many positive qualities live inside, and it's like energy that's bound up in repression. But as soon as we give attention and love, we discover this kind of treasure. And so that part of us can feel great joy. So this is the third part, from self to vulnerability to joy. as a child could experience great joy. I mean, this is, I just had this memory, like, sitting here before the talk. I don't even know why, but I just thought my neighbor was, like, the coolest thing on earth. I was 8 years old, and we had moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma from Iran, where I lived for 6 years, from 2 to 8. And our neighbor was named Brad Bradley. And next to him was Dick Dickinson. But no, in serious, my neighbor was really named Brad Bradley. He was 16 years old. He had sideburns. This was like 1968. And I just thought, like, he wore a shirt with jeans. You know, I don't know why that memory came to me, but I just remember meeting this guy. I was so awed by him. He could have said anything, you know, and I would have followed him to the ends of the earth. I have no idea why. I was just a kid. That's the way kids are, right? That lives inside your vulnerability. This ability to just be awestruck in wonder over nothing. Or actually not nothing at all, because you, the child, I mean, remember how you used to play with your toys or your dolls, you know, and how into it you got. I mean, I don't know why we were so into this as kids. Our biggest thing to do was, me and my two brothers and my cousins, we would build a huge, take the all the sand in the sandbox, build a huge kind of cone of sand, and then dig tunnels in it and little bobsled runs, and then drop a golf ball down and watch the golf ball, like, go around and, you know, come out. And, like, we did that for months and years. We were so into it. It was the coolest thing you could ever imagine. Right? That's your kid heart. So, and, you know, inside your vulnerability, we're all so serious. Whoa, we're being silent, and we have to be silent. And, you know, your teacher keeps reminding you to be silent. So, okay, we have to be silent. We can't express this. But you find it anyway in your metta. And then you can have a childlike love for Dharma, for your practice, anything the practice does for you. How great. I mean, how great that you can sit and be with some phrases, you know, more than just a few at a time. So the kid inside is there. And you can find it. Just be open. All you have to do is be the friend to everything that arises. Now, we also have, do y'all know this phrase, nourishment barrier? I first heard it from a shamanic teacher, but she's very psychologically oriented. We can be very timid about accessing joy, because it's risky. Because if you really experience joy, someone might laugh at you, because you're going to completely lose your sense of self-consciousness. And you're just going to express your joy. And undoubtedly, you will probably, if you have a nourishment barrier, undoubtedly, that's there because you were just in your kid-like, childlike, unself-conscious state, like maybe singing a song about Brad Bradley and his sideburns, and I want to grow up and be a man and be 15 and I'll be a man and I'll have sideburns, and you're just singing a little song about it, and your older brother makes fun of you. That never happened to me, but I'm sure something like that did. So, and that hits really hard because we're so open and undefended. I, like a friend of mine once said, embarrassment is suppressed joy. it's too vulnerable to really allow your joy. So you feel embarrassed instead. It's sort of like you don't tell that lady you think she's as peaceful as the North Star, you know, at the Safeway. So you tell her you love her hair. Because you just don't want to be that vulnerable and open. So inside your vulnerability lies your joy. And to be joyful is to risk more vulnerability, which needs more metta. So that's the good news. You just keep practicing metta. And the tough stuff's good. The joy is good. Your timidity is good. It's all good. Ding. It's 8:30. Taking ourselves lightly. We told some jokes about Christianity and Judaism and Unitarianism, but nothing on Buddhism. Come on. But you know all my Buddhist jokes. It's no fun. I don't know. Do you want a cartoon or two just to end the talk? This is sort of funny because this cartoon is first day of Zen Garden School. And there's four monks in the, you know, the sand pit, you know, where you're supposed to rake, you know, and make this really beautiful, serene Zen garden. But on the first day, so one monk has stepped on a rake and hit himself in the head with it. And you see him in the robes. One monk is doing snow angels in the Zen garden. One monk is building a pyramidal looking sand cone. Maybe he's going to do a golf ball roll. And then one monk is in front building a sandcastle. And then the senior monk is just on the side like this. So you might like to look at that. We can make fun of our tradition. Here's a Buddhist superhero. Karma Man. There is a hero who embodies courage, who stands on the side of the righteous, and you see him in his suit up like this. He is Karma Man. And a woman is standing next to him. She's saying, "Hey, that man stole my purse." Karma Man is just standing there like this. He's like, "Don't worry, ma'am. He'll get what's coming to him." Eventually. He's just standing there. Bruce Eric Kaplan, the New Yorker cartoon, he does a lot of New Yorker cartoons. He must practice mindfulness. He has a lot of meditation cartoons. One meditator in full lotus is saying to another meditator, "I never liked his stillness." Or a wife is saying to her husband, who's sitting cross-legged on the floor in full lotus, "Can you be in the moment later?" Come on, haven't you all seen all these? You haven't seen all these? Come on. All right, just a few more. We can make fun of reincarnation. Here's a pile of ashes on a cloud with a little pair of wings next to just a dude with a pair of wings, and the little pile of ashes is saying, "If I had to do it over again, I definitely wouldn't have been cremated." Or you know this Buddhist compliment. the teacher saying to the student, "I've never met anyone so thoughtless in my life." Keep up the good work. Thank you, Master. Here's a great Larson one. Nerds in hell. You just have to see him in line. Hot enough for ya? He's in line in hell talking to another guy in hell. You just have to see it. I just think it's so funny. You gotta see it, Josh. Okay. All right. This is all recorded. I'm gonna put it on the World Wide Web so people can see what a how we're just closely adhering to the Theravada tradition. It's not quite the straight and narrow Theravada. We have to show Josh the nerds in hell.
That's right here.
Enough for you. These nerds are such nice people. They really have the really good metta hearts.
I was in a steam bath once, and it was so thick you couldn't even see. And a friend of mine said, "It's not so much the heat as it is the humidity."
A farmer in Vermont said to me once, he fell off a ladder and he's like, "It wasn't the fall that hurt so much, but the sudden stop at the end." Okay. You think Josh is that funny?
It's
kind of fun. Come on! Oh my god, that's the funniest cartoon. I'm just a nerd at heart. I love nerds. Nerds are so well-meaning and nice and sincere and earnest. Just trying to make small talk. It's a nerd. Hell, what are you going to talk about? You're just gonna totally state the obvious, like, you're about to be fried. Come on. How is that not funny?
You are like 10 times funnier than this cartoon.
Oh my god. Okay. I'm so glad I'm recording. Alright. Phew.
Is it hot in here or what?
Hot enough for you, Josh.